Okay, so we are continuing our study now of the last of the kings of Judah. We've kind of are at an interesting transition point. As all we have left now are kings of Judah, and now of those kings, we're left with the immediate descendants of righteous King Josiah that we recently finished studying about. So last week we had the opportunity to look at the very brief reign of his firstborn son, Jehoahaz, who was only on the throne for 3 months. But where this is an interesting transition point is up to now, 2 Chronicles has provided for us the greater detail and information concerning the kings of Judah. When in 2 Kings, or 1 Kings, and then 2 Kings, the emphasis after the division of the kingdom after Solomon died, the emphasis of 1 and 2 Kings was on the events and the reigns of the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom. Well, it was put out of existence. The Lord brought the Assyrians against them and punishment, and they were destroyed in the time of the reign of Hezekiah, king of Judah. So after that, it's been Judah by itself. There was a remnant of those tribes of the north and Israel that were scattered among the nations that the Assyrians had conquered. But they were never to return to Israel. They were lost to history from that point, as they had already lost their distinctiveness as God's people long before. So after a little over 200 years of rebellion, continuous rebellion against the Lord, that kingdom, those tribes were gone. So then Judah was on its own, but we've seen that from that point, 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles really paralleling the same events, because that's all that's left. The kings of Judah and the people of Judah and Jerusalem. But now, as we get to this very end, we have all of the information about the last 4 kings of Israel, which included 3 of Josiah's son and 1 grandson, that it's all packed into that final chapter, 2 Chronicles 36. So we don't have a lot of detail in 2 Chronicles, which used to be the place where we found the most details about the kings of Judah. But 2 Chronicles wraps it up rather quickly in summarizing those reigns and telling us about the fall of Jerusalem. So we're going to find more detail of those things in 2 Kings. And so right now we are at the very end of looking at the end of 2 Kings chapter 23. And we also then have chapters 24 and 25 after that. So we have 2 chapters remaining to study in 2 Kings and 1, the parallel chapter of 2 Chronicles 36, to go there. So as we're looking at this, we're actually going to find even more information in the books of the prophets, especially the book of Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah was, as we saw last week, the Lord called Jeremiah to be a prophet. Well, he had chosen him to be such from the womb, but he called Jeremiah in his youth to be the Lord's prophet. And so he began to speak God's word as it was given to him. We saw this in the first 2 verses of the book of Jeremiah. In the 13th year of King Josiah. So that's when Jeremiah's work as God's prophet began. And it would continue through all of these events that we're reading about through the rest of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, through the remainder of the days of the kingdom of Judah and beyond, after that even. Jeremiah is around for all of this. He's a witness to all of these events. The Lord had him there, right here in the middle of all these people with these kings. And he was the primary tool the Lord was using at that point to speak his word, to give the warnings and the rebukes, the calls to repentance. I mean, that really is at the heart of what the book of Jeremiah is about, and during this time frame. So just to provide some context for that, what we're reading here in our study now is the background of the book of Jeremiah, and which should help us when we study that book to properly understand what's going on and what the Lord, who the Lord was saying those things to and why. But a lot of those things we do want to review as it pertains to our study here. I mean, obviously we can't look at all of the book of Jeremiah with this. It would be good, but we'll try to tie in a few of those things that are that follow along with these events that we are told about here in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles in these final chapters of those two books, which we will have the opportunity to do, Lord willing, as we now begin to study about the reign of Jehoiakim, the second son of Josiah. What happened to his first son, Jehoahaz? Well, that also ties into what happened to Josiah and how he died. How did Josiah die? He went out and met the Pharaoh, Necho, who had come up through the land on his way to meet the king of Assyria. And so Josiah came out to meet him. Necho warned him that he was on God's mission and that he wasn't coming against Josiah. But Josiah came against him there, and Josiah was slain by Pharaoh and his armies at Megiddo. And so there the Egyptians were in that region of Israel at that time. And so having slain the king, well, then the people anointed his son, his firstborn son, Jehoahaz, to be his successor, to be the next king of Judah. Well, evidently the Necho was still in the region. He whatever campaign he was on did not end within a couple of days, and then the Egyptians went home. So within 3 months, while the Egyptians were there, Necho removed Jehoahaz from the throne of Judah and had him carried down to Egypt. So he was taken there as Necho's prisoner. What happened to Jehoahaz after that? Well, the only thing that we're not told the timing of when it happened, whether it was soon or whether it was much later, but we're told that he died in the land of Egypt. So he was taken off the throne, carried to Egypt, and that's where he spent the rest of his days, however many there were, after only a 3-month reign on the throne of Judah. And what kind of person was Jehoahaz? He was evil. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. How is he going to differ from his brothers? Not at all in that. So the other sons of righteous Josiah were also wicked, and we had the opportunity to delve into that in our study last week, and to look at that that situation and what was going on with them in spite of the righteousness of their father. And it's very sad to see these sons of his that were so wicked, in spite of what Josiah had done to try to teach them and all the people of Judah to love and serve God, but they did not. And the people weren't with Josiah either. So he didn't he really, in spite of all of his efforts, how many of the people of Judah were converted to the Lord during Josiah's time, and how many of his own children? It was a bad situation there spiritually. I mean, among the worst times that we read about, really it is the worst time that we read about for the kingdom of Judah. We're not going to have any more righteous kings in Judah. All we're seeing now is the final events as the Lord is bringing punishments for all of this wickedness that they had been engaged in for so long, with that exception of the time of Josiah's reign and Hezekiah's. But other than that, I mean, it's been a for many years, it's been a decline in their following God, and their an increase in their wickedness, to the point where they had, under Manasseh, as we know, they had filled Jerusalem with the innocent blood of their children that they'd sacrificed to worship their idols. Josiah cleaned up all of those high places and all the and where they had done those wicked deeds. He destroyed all of that, but it did not convert the hearts of the people. They were still not with the Lord, and they were still turned against him. And as soon as Josiah is gone, there's no restraint, and so his children that serve as kings and all the people, they fully go after the evil for the remaining time that they have. But this is where the Lord is bringing in the punishment for all of this. He deferred it while Josiah was still alive because of Josiah's humility and righteousness and obedience. So he told him he was not going to bring it about in his time, but now that he's dead, the Lord starts to bring the punishment. Well, who does he bring first? The Egyptians under Necho. So the Pharaoh, having killed Josiah, then takes his firstborn son, removes him from the throne after being on it for only 3 months, carries him down to Egypt where he dies, and then he puts his, as we would call it in by the terms of the day, his puppet on the throne of Judah, the second son of Josiah, who is Jehoiakim. And when he puts Jehoiakim on the throne, he puts the land of Judah to tribute. We saw that in the final verses of 2 Kings chapter 23, and it's also in the beginning of 2 Chronicles 36. For now, let us do go to 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and we want to look at verses 4 through 8, where we'll actually look at 4 through 8, that will very briefly in these five verses cover the reign of Jehoiakim. As we noted, there's a lot more information about him and his reign and what he did in 2 Kings and in the book of Jeremiah particularly. But this is all we have from 2 Chronicles 36, verses 4 through 8. It says, "And the king of Egypt made Eliakim, his brother, king over Judah and Jerusalem, and turned his name to Jehoiakim. And Necho took Jehoahaz, his brother, and carried him to Egypt. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. Against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also carried of the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his temple at Babylon. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and his abominations which he did, and that which was found in him, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah, and Jehoiachin his son reigned in his stead." Well, that's all we got in 2 Chronicles about Jehoiakim and his reign. And as far as the summary of it, it's right there. How is it summarized? What kind of a man was Jehoiakim? He was an evil man, as it mentions, and that which was found in him. What was found in him, and where was it in him, and who found it? There was evil in his heart. Of course, the Lord is the one that searches that out. And so he was weighed in the Lord's scales and certainly found wanting, using language that God used also of Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar. But we can see that in Jehoiakim. And so he was evil, and the Lord found that evil in him. He ended up being, he was conquered and overcome by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Well, that tells us, so his reign begins by being put on the throne by Necho, the Pharaoh of Egypt. His reign ends at the behest of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. So in those 11 years that he reigned, it starts with Egypt dominating him, and then it ends with Babylon dominating him. So that also raises the question, what happens to Egypt in the meantime? If Egypt was still what she was under Necho at the beginning of Jehoiakim's reign, would we likely find that description of how Jehoiakim's reign ended by the Babylonians? Or did something change for Egypt during that time? Something did change for Egypt during that time. Who's doing all of this? Who raised up Necho, used him to start this punishment of Judah by taking Jehoahaz off the throne and carrying him to Egypt, putting the land to tribute? I mean, that's all punishment, and it's from God, and he was using the Egyptians first, but that didn't last long. Now, is that what Necho was thinking or expecting? No. Which of those rulers ever expects their end to come, and come when it does, or the way it does? And they don't, because what kind of problem do they have? They've got pride, and so we can see that in Necho. But God raised him up, and what's God going to do with him? He's going to abase him, and he's going to cause Egypt to fall to whom? He's going to give Pharaoh and Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar. And so that's going to be all part of God's work. In fact, who does he give to Nebuchadnezzar? It'd be an easier question to ask, who did he not? all those nations around them in that time, God gave to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He gave them into their hands, into Nebuchadnezzar's hands, as punishment for all the wickedness that they had done, and it was much. So he did that for all these nations. Now, then after that, what did he do? What did he do with Nebuchadnezzar himself? Well, he abased Nebuchadnezzar and removed him from his kingdom without yet making Babylon fall, because he taught Nebuchadnezzar, he taught him the lesson that he had the same problem that all these other ones had. Who did Nebuchadnezzar think was doing all that he was doing? Well, before we read about Necho, I mean, who was the one causing all the trouble for Judah prior to that, and that we read about? Who caused the northern kingdom to fall? And who did God give such a marvelous deliverance to? Hezekiah. Who did he give a marvelous deliverance of his people to during Hezekiah's time? All that was the Assyrians. Well, we read at that time Isaiah 10. I mean, Sennacherib. Who did he think was doing what he was doing? Who did he give the credit to? Himself. Was Necho any different? The Pharaoh? Was Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, any different? All these ones were the same in that. Now, there was something different with Nebuchadnezzar, because these other ones God put down. Nebuchadnezzar, the Lord saw something there in him that he could teach in his heart. And he taught him the lesson without him having to fall like the others. And so he was, all this is in Daniel chapter 4, but he taught Nebuchadnezzar that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. And did Nebuchadnezzar learn that? And did he extol the God of heaven after that? And did he give him glory for the kingdom that he was given, that's what he did. So that was very unusual in that situation. But God was the one doing all of this. So he did it with Assyria. He raised Assyria up. I mean, who's the one that brought the Assyrian Empire to its end? Well, it's Nebuchadnezzar, one of the if I were to ask for anybody to raise up their hand that had taken history classes back in school and had to remember dates and was that horrible, probably most of the hands, if not all of them in here, would go up for some strange reason except for mine. But anyway, I liked all those dates and stuff, but I know it's that's different. But for the most part, I mean, most people don't like to have to memorize the dates and these things. There is, for us, when we're thinking about the events of the Old Testament, one date that's very good to remember and an event is the year 605 B.C. And that's an important date, not just in secular history, but as it ties into biblical history that we're studying. That was the year of the Battle of Carchemish, where Nebuchadnezzar defeated Assyria, was on its way down, and so they fell to Nebuchadnezzar at that time. And that's the year when Nebuchadnezzar becomes emperor, and so Babylon becomes the empire, ruled by Nebuchadnezzar as the emperor that year. But all that was recorded in the Babylonian records, and they also noted lunar and solar eclipses, especially the solar ones that were tied into the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. It enables the dates to be known for events, historical events of that time, and tying into the Bible. So that's where we're able to, that's a big event where we're able to then know in terms of like what year B.C. things happened. Because once you have the precise dates of an eclipse, I mean, that those follow patterns. That's why they can be predicted when they're going to come, but you can also go backwards and know when they happen from that. So anyway, so that's a very important date and time, but has a lot of significance in biblical history. So Nebuchadnezzar's reign started in 605 B.C. As emperor of Babylon after the Battle of Carchemish. So the Assyrians fell, and then Egypt also fell to the Babylonians during that time. And so this was all God's work and what he was doing in according with his purposes, in spite of the fact that those rulers and kingdoms, did they see that it was God doing all of that, and did they acknowledge that, with the exception of Nebuchadnezzar and what he had to learn and how, because he didn't himself up until God taught him. But that's the way it was. So the others didn't recognize it was God's work, but did that mean that it wasn't? Does man have to understand that God's doing something for it to mean that God is doing something? No. God is doing what he's doing regardless of what man may say about it or not. So it didn't change. It didn't change the fact that God was the one ruling in the kingdoms of men at that time. It doesn't change the fact that he's doing so now, which is a reason we're making a point about it. How many people today acknowledge that what's going on in the world, that God is the one that is in control of all these things, that he's the one raising up the nations, and he's the one that is still putting the rulers in these nations, that he's still ruling in all things. The heavens do rule. They always have, and by God, and he always will. So today, how many people acknowledge that this is all God's work? Are the Russians and Ukrainians just doing their own thing. Just as an example, I mean, because that they kind of, a lot of those events over there dominate the news. But I mean, who's raised them up? Who's put them? I don't know how it's all going to end, but who's the one doing it? I mean, it's the Lord's work, and He's doing something. He's got something in His mind. He's got something in His plans, and He's executing that. And it's going to turn out according to whatever His plans are. Now, we don't have a prophet among us today to tell us what's going to happen. So do we know precisely how it's going to end up? No. But what do we know? The Lord's in control. He's doing it. Now, I mean, can anybody see with their eyes? Can they see that, okay, this is God doing this? No. And how many people? Is He ever mentioned in the headlines? Or in the stories that follow underneath the headlines? God has raised up Putin, and God has raised up Zelensky, and God is doing this and has sent this one against that one. Is that how the news presents it? People still don't believe it, but if it were stated accurately, isn't that what it would say? But that's the truth, and we know that from this, and that's important for us to understand, that, and we get to see the examples of that here. So with what happens to Egypt in Jehoiakim's reign, so Necho, he thinks he's in full control here. He has Jehoahaz off the throne. He kills Josiah, then he takes his son off the throne, puts another one on the throne, changes his name, dictates how much tribute he's going to have to pay by year. Let's go back to 2 Kings 23, from verse 34 down to verse 7 of chapter 24. 2 Kings 23, verse 34, down to chapter 24, verse 7. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah his father, and turned his name to Jehoiakim, and took Jehoahaz away. And he came to Egypt and died there. And Jehoiakim gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give the money according to the commandment of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land, of everyone according to his taxation, to give it unto Pharaoh Necho. Now, when God's people are obeying him, are they going to be in that kind of a situation where they're being taxed to pay a yearly amount demanded by the king of another nation? For this situation, for this problem to exist at all, means what's going on spiritually in Judah. Well, this is part of the curses that God brought on his people, that he had warned them about. I mean, these were things that Josiah read about when the law of the Lord was discovered, and he knew what was coming. God said he was going to not do it in his time because he humbled himself. But this is what God had told them he would do if they didn't keep his commandments, and they didn't. And they're still not. So this is part of the curses right here. Now they're put under tribute to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. This is the beginning of that judgment. So they're under Pharaoh and under his control. Now, of course, it's under God's control. He's the one doing this. Now, what does Pharaoh think about all this? I mean, Necho is without doubt fully confident that he's the one in control, and he's the one dictating all of this and making it happen. But he's going to learn. He's going to learn otherwise pretty soon, that that's not the case. So verse 36 here in 2 Kings 23 says, Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And that's exactly what we saw there in 2 Chronicles 36. And it says, and his mother's name was Zebudah, the daughter of Padeath of Remalt. All right, so his mother was Zebudah. Hamutal was the mother of Jehoahaz. So different mothers of these two sons, these two kings. The sons are, the mothers are different, but the hearts of the sons aren't. Verse 37, the last verse of 2 Chronicles 23 says, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. So that's the description of Jehoiakim and his heart. So we read about these two evil sons so far, and there's one more to come, Zedekiah. The king's children were evil, Josiah's, even though Josiah was righteous. And we asked a question last week. We don't have the precise answer to it, but it is a question at least worthy of consideration. Josiah did everything he could to convert the people of the land, made all of them in a covenant to serve the Lord with all his heart, soul, mind, and strength. They were faking it, as the Lord told us in Jeremiah 3. So were his sons. Well, what about his wives? Is it possible they were faking it too? And do we have hypocrites for sons that were evil because that was also what their mothers were? And so was that the influence? Well, again, that's a possibility as far as at least just asking the question. We don't have the answer. But even if the mothers were sincere and righteous, I mean, how much corruption and evil and hypocrisy was all around them anyway? So whether the devil got them using their mothers or whether the devil got them using others in addition to or in spite of both parents, however it worked, I mean, there was so much evil around and hypocrisy, and we know for sure that that's what happened with the king's sons. But it is interesting to see him mention their mothers. And it's possible that they had the same problem that everybody else did, and that sure would not have helped the situation. I mean, Josiah was swimming upstream, however it was, but it may have been even worse than we know. Chapter 24 begins and says, in his days, of course, this is Jehoiakim's days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. Nebuchadnezzar's rise is going to coincide with the fall of Egypt. I mean, is there going to be room for Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon with the Assyrians and the Egyptians? No. Who's going to win out and who's going to be in control of all of this? It's Nebuchadnezzar because of God. God's the one, even though Nebuchadnezzar's going to credit himself with all of this. But we can see the rise of Babylon now and Nebuchadnezzar. So Jehoiakim begins at being under the thumb of Pharaoh, and he ends under the thumb of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Even though he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't say he rebelled against Necho. Well, Necho is the one that put him on the throne and gave him a new name. So it's quite evident that he understood that the conditions for him to be able to, his brother having already been removed and carried off to Egypt by Necho, what would have happened if Jehoiakim had rebelled? So he had that much fear, evidently, to not attempt this in the time of Necho. But when Nebuchadnezzar takes over, and then the tribute's going to go to Nebuchadnezzar now. At this point, Jehoiakim rebels against that. So verse 2 says, and the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldees and bands of the Syrians and bands of the Moabites and bands of the children of Ammon. Now, who's not coming against him? Look at that. So he starts off with the problem with the Egyptians, and then what does he get? I mean, you got the Chaldees, so here you got the Babylonians, but then you got all these local nations that surround the near neighbors of Israel, Syria and Moab and Ammon. Who does it say that sent all of them? It says the Lord did it and sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by his servants, the prophets. So here comes the judgment of God. So he's put them under tribute. Now these nations are, all these different ones are coming against them. This didn't happen under Josiah. And because God said he wasn't going to do it then. But this is what the judgment of God looks like. And it's going to get much, much worse. This is going to endure throughout the reign of Jehoiakim. His son, Jehoiachin, is only going to have a brief 3-month reign. And he's going to be removed by Nebuchadnezzar, just like Jehoahaz had been removed by Pharaoh of Egypt. And then Zedekiah is going to be installed on the throne of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar in the same way that Jehoiakim was by Necho, the Pharaoh. And Zedekiah is going to have an identical 11-year reign, just like Jehoiakim. So it's interesting. Jehoahaz had a 3-month reign, removed by Necho, who installed his brother Jehoiakim, who then reigns 11 years. When he dies, his son Jehoiachin becomes king, but he only reigns 3 months, removed by the Nebuchadnezzar. And then Zedekiah, the last brother, is put on the throne of Judah, and he reigns 11 years. So we have 3 months, 11 years, 3 months, 11 years for the duration of the reigns of the last four kings of Judah that followed Josiah. Two mighty rulers were involved two by two. Necho, Pharaoh of Egypt, and then Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. So there is a pattern there. So this is what God was doing. This was his judgment. Of course, under Zedekiah then, finally, he's going to rebel, and Nebuchadnezzar is going to come, and there's going to be siege and famine and all the horrible things that went with that. So all those curses, everything you go to back to Deuteronomy 28, which we're not right now, but go back and review all those curses, and all of it is going to be taking place and coming to pass during these years. God poured it all out on them here, just like he said he would, and that's what he's saying also here. And then verse 3, it says, surely, this is in 2 Kings 24, verse 3, surely at the commandment of the Lord came that upon Judah to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he did, and also for the innocent blood that he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiachin his son reigned in his stead. And the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land. For the king of Babylon had taken from the river of Egypt under the river Euphrates all that pertained to the king of Egypt. So there's an interesting statement about what happened and why we started off reading about mighty Egypt, and then suddenly we're reading about Babylon and no more Egypt. What happened? God raised up Nebuchadnezzar to put down all of these, including the Egyptians. Let's turn over now to the book of Ezekiel, to Ezekiel chapter 29. We're going to read just a bit of this, what God was doing during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and how it also involved Egypt. Now these different nations around Israel, they were going to be put down by Nebuchadnezzar, by God through Nebuchadnezzar. And there was a particular judgment that God had in store for Tyre and Sidon. He was going to give them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar too. I'm going to mention another chapter to look at that covers all of this. Jeremiah 25. He speaks about giving the cup of his wrath and indignation for all these nations to drink. And he goes through the list of them. It's impressive. But he was going to give all of these nations to drink of the cup of the wine of God's wrath, using Nebuchadnezzar to give them the cup to drink from. And he mentions Tyre and Sidon there too. But Jeremiah 25 gives the list. I mean, after all that was over, eventually God's judgment of the Babylonians would come too, wouldn't it? And it did. But they would end up taking a drink from that cup as well. But he was going to use them to give the cup to drink to all these others. And so here we're reading about that as it pertained to Tyre and Sidon in Ezekiel 29, starting at verse 17. It says, "And it came to pass in the 27th year, in the first month, in the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, caused his army to serve a great service against Tyrus. Every head was made bald and every shoulder was peeled. Yet had he no wages, nor his army for Tyrus for the service that he had served against it." Now pausing there, if we had more time, we'd go back a few pages and read about what the king of Tyre had to say about himself and why God was going to abase him using Nebuchadnezzar. Tyrus called himself God. So he had no small pride at all. And God in this very book, in prophesying against him, said, are you going to call yourself God when the one is bringing the sword against you at the end? No, stop. You can't kill me. I'm God. I mean, is that what he was going to be able? What sense does that make? He was going to be exposed as being very much a man at that time, and was. So God put them down, and who did the service? Nebuchadnezzar did God's service. But he didn't have any wages for it. So he did the work for God, even though he doesn't know he was doing it for God yet. But God was going to give him some wages for his work. What would the wages be? Verses 19 through 21. "Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will give the land of Egypt unto Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he shall take her multitude, and take her spoil, and take her prey, and it shall be the wages for his army. I have given him the land of Egypt for his labor wherewith he served against it, because they wrought for me, saith the Lord God. In that day will I cause the horn of the house of Israel to bud forth, and I will give thee the opening of the mouth in the midst of them, and they shall know that I am the Lord." So Nebuchadnezzar performed God's work on Tyre, and then God gave Egypt as his wages for that work. Now again, did Nebuchadnezzar recognize or acknowledge any of that at the time? No, he didn't see that as he was doing God's bidding against Tyre, and then he got Egypt as wages for that from the Lord. He was thinking, hey, look at what I've done. I've done all this. But he wasn't. God was doing it. But notice, who did God give to Nebuchadnezzar as wages? Egypt. That was going to be Necho. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 46. We do have to look at passages in these other places, and with these prophets in particular, to get a full view and understanding of these events that he's recording. Because he says it in one verse there in 2 Kings 24, verse 7, about how Necho and Egypt fell to Nebuchadnezzar. But this is giving more explanation of it. Now, this is a 28-verse chapter, Jeremiah 26 is, which we don't have time to read in its entirety right now. So here's another one that I offer to you to look at in full detail. But Jeremiah 46 is a prophecy of those events of the giving of Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar as his wages. In verse 1 it says, "The word of the Lord which came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Gentiles, against Egypt, against the army of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates and Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah." So Carchemish was the final end to Assyria, but who was there trying as an ally and also fell to Nebuchadnezzar at that time? That was a great battle, 605 BC. Fourth year of Jehoiakim, that was the end of Necho. But that also puts it in time frame. So Necho put Jehoiakim on the throne and changed his name, put him to tribute, and then in his fourth year, Necho's gone. Jehoiakim had an 11-year reign, but four of it was with Necho dominating him, but then Nebuchadnezzar is going to be around for the other seven, and be the one to ultimately take him out. But we're seeing we've seen now the rise of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, who is standing before Nebuchadnezzar at this time? Nobody, because God's giving the cup of his wrath as a drink to all these nations, and using Babylon to do it. All right, Lord willing, we'll look further at a few more passages in Jeremiah about Jehoiakim, because to really understand all of his evil that he did and the judgment that God brought on him for it, we do have to look at some other passages in the book of Jeremiah. So we'll try to look at that, Lord willing, next Sunday morning. And then we have the brief reign of his son Jehoiachin, and finally Zedekiah. So we'll continue all this study, Lord willing, next Lord's Day. But let's go to our Heavenly Father now in prayer.